Okay, this is Cameron and Bob again. This is session 44, and we're in the new year. It's January 20th, 2022, and we're on page 81 of my book pamphlet, Broadside. And at the top, there's a quote from McLuhan, Hot and Cool, Gerald Stern, the editor, and there's an essay by Howard Luck Gossage, McLuhan's buddy, and this is what he says. Something else has happened, too. It has become an art form. If it is successful as an art form and is admired and copied, or at any rate persists so that it eventually becomes the one and only from which all others emanate, it constitutes an archetype. Today's archetype was yesterday's art form, day before yesterday's cliche, and the day before that it was the last word. Now, I read that in 67, 68 when it came out. I'm really glad I did. I thought that's a really interesting pattern, and I hadn't heard McLuhan use it. But then cliche archetype comes out in 70, 70, 71, and I recognize it's a distillation of the Gossage quote. So I started using this a lot in talking to people and in seeing what things were doing. You know, I'd say that something became an art form, but it wasn't an archetype yet. Now, when you read cliched archetype, it gets blurred. And I would be particular about which phase something was. McLuhan wasn't. He was messy. But then when City's Classroom came out in 77, he says in there, it's, you know, cliche or archetype or backwards. He was including, it didn't matter which way you took it. And then as I got more familiar with Finnegan's Wake around that time, I saw the shifting of Shem and Sean. You know, they were flipping in each other all the time, plus the sister, and into the parents. So I said, okay, there's McLuhan being Finneganese. He's not going to have hard and defined white hats, black hats, or dualities. He's going to blur them. He's going to have to blur them. And so I realized that people reading McLuhan, the literate baby boomers, would say, the guy is mixed up. He contradicts himself. You know, they would complain. And that's what they didn't recognize, is the blurring of the categories. And you had to get into Finnegan's Wake to that, and not many people in the 60s, 70s would go into Finnegan's Wake. But
Well, there's actually multiple blurrings going on.
Yes.
Because if you want to have things that are distinct, you're necessarily talking in linear fashion.
Yeah.
And so once you become simultaneous, then it's necessary for those formerly clear categories to be seen to be overlapping, to be simultaneous, and then they get blurry.
Yeah.
But at another way of looking at this is that the Gutenberg galaxy is always dualistic, pointing to a singularity.
Yeah.
And so once you get away from dualisms and singularities, away from the Gutenberg galaxy, then things become blurry when thought of in Gutenbergian terms.
Right. That's when you become a musician. That's when you realize Marshall was a musician.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah. And then, you know, years later, I saw Baudrillard saw that. So I give him credit for knowing that. I think he's the first guy to write it in a book, you know, that McLuhan, I regard McLuhan as a musician. I don't think anybody ever said that other than him. I was saying it conversationally, but I wasn't a published author, so it didn't
matter.
Well,
McLuhan was saying that about himself.
Yeah. Well, I never caught him saying it ever, I don't think. I'm not sure. He would, Picnic in Space, he and Harley are talking about what a genius is, and McLuhan is diminishing the bourgeois hypnotism of the genius. So, and then there was a quote of way back there. They asked McLuhan if he considered himself an artist, and he says, yes, what I do can be considered poetry or art, but I wouldn't limit it to that. You know, he wasn't trying to be the Gutenberg archetype. It wasn't a big deal to be an artist anymore.
Right.
As a culture hero.
Ever since he read Gideon, Space, Time, and Architecture, which was 1943,
yeah.
He was very involved with the symphony metaphor.
Yep.
So he was always talking about how it was necessary to bring the different departments in the university or different images in literature or science and art, that these things had to be brought into tune, into their existing symphonic relationship. So there's a metaphor, a topic of music that runs through McLuhan's work from at least 1943 until the end.
Yeah, now in 45 or so, when he does the Southern Quality and talks about the effect of the atomic bomb, he says the artist has too big of an ego to handle the effects of this. So McLuhan entered academia attacking the archetypes, the icons of science and art, the scientist, the artist, the genius. He knew that didn't work anymore. And I don't know if anybody had realized that. Maybe, beg your pardon?
That relates closely to what we were just saying about blurring.
Yes.
Right. He didn't have anything against the artist and the scientist. What he had an animus for was their separation and their isolation from each other.
Yeah.
So
and their art versus, you know, commerce versus humanism and stuff like that.
Correct.
They didn't work anymore, and so we were cyborgian. We were inside the technical apparatus, and the categories, the humanist chemical body categories, didn't work anymore. So he, you know, the beatniks might have seen that, but they didn't know how to keep their lives organized. They had an identity crisis around it. They all reached out to Buddhism or drugs and LSD and stuff. They became a knee-jerk. McLuhan called women in the cultures of business no longer the mechanical bribe; they were the expendable jujube, which was a candy.
Yeah,
you remember that? They're expendable.
No, I don't remember it, but that's a funny phrase.
Yeah, jujube, and he pointed out that experience, sensory experience, was not experience anymore. It was not about going out and experiencing some new strange territory and plunging into horizontal symbolism, losing your identity. That's what the culture became. That became cultural tourism, and the what he called millennial ecstatics from the 60s on. That's what he was critiquing. Yet everybody who got inspired by McLuhan, his content, they thought, oh, wow, he's justifying what I'm doing. He's an existentialist. And so they would go and hang out with him to see if he was partying, and he wasn't. And this would confuse people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he really was an anti-environment to the millennial ecstatics that was happening.
Sure.
And millennial ecstatics is a phrase in the introduction, I think, of the other McLuhan collection of essays called Pro and Con, which came out a year after Hot and Cool. That's a good collection, but it's talking about McLuhan teaching a course at Fordham. Raymond Rosenthal was the editor. He, you know, interviewed McLuhan or something, but he came up with this phrase. I never saw McLuhan ever use it, other than he was quoted there, millennial ecstatics, and that's what he was looking at. And that's a big factor in my chart. You know, I've got ecstasy is one-fifth of the situation, but I've got the other emotions, paranoia, schizophrenia, panic, and hysteria. But ecstasy has to be in there, and it's actually the main one. People were stoned on the superangelic state, and they didn't know it, or they didn't know how it obsolesced their previous enthusiasms. Do you see what I'm saying? In fact, they kept running around trying to reinforce their previous enthusiasms and trying to make time to do it. And that always ended up in a dead end because they already were in a state of pleasure or ecstasy invisibly or numbly. You follow what I'm saying?
A little bit. Are you saying that these were people that were wearing clothes that they didn't know they were wearing?
Yes, the new clothes they didn't know they were wearing, and they were trying to take off their old clothes or make their old clothes more exciting.
Yeah, and there's a big contradiction between having a jacket on and trying to do something with your old jacket.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it becomes a funny kind of pantomime.
Well, that's where he has in Cultures Are Business, he has the ad of the working class guy dressed up to go to the opera, and McLuhan says, this is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Or a sheep in wolf's clothing. Do you remember that image?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was Cultures Are Business. I mean, the democratization of the elite activities of the highbrow art forms and sciences of the Gutenberg era became the content for the democratic man, you know, the third phase of Vico,
yeah.
which was flipping into the Ricorso. So what was I going to say next? So we're looking at what Gossage says. The last word, okay, a novelty comes in. The Beatles say, or punk rock, or rap. And it's the last word. The kids and young people doing it think it's the most amazing archetypal experience they can have. And they argue against the older environment. They make fun of it, which is the cliché. So the last word is up against the cliché, and probably the star of the fad is trying to be an image from the past that has new charisma. Often it would be Aboriginal cultures, to be a shaman. So I remember an interview with the Mamas and Papas guy, John, whatever his name was, and he said, you know, where are the Shelleys and the Lord Byron? He was talking about the pop heroes, the pop music aristocracy. They weren't, they were big just before FM radio, 65, 66, and yet they were beatniks. So you know, so
they were playing at beatniks.
Yeah, and yeah. So when they got interviewed, they bragged about their Gutenbergian archetype they thought they were retrieving. And then maybe 10 years later, the next generations were not going for the book archetypes like Byron and the poets. They were going for shamans or the Carlos Castaneda world, the drug-taking world. Meanwhile, the population was taking in the 70s more and more cocaine, right? Ridiculously out of control. So the retrieving of some shaman thing is the art form phase. And then to even start a band by the 80s is an archetypal thing. Everybody does it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
In the youth culture. Which was what everybody was looking at to bounce off of. So I have here the last word is rhetorical. Action of the new effects, immediately persuasive. then the cliche is the dialectical action of resistance to the effects. And that's Hegelian, relatively ignored. Then the art form of retrieval is grammatical action of the effects as metonymy, searching for origins or for new images of culture heroes, which could be people were ransacking the planet for that. Then the archetype is the musical, geometrical, astronomical, and arithmetical, all of them, all aspects of the quadrivium, action of the effects and cyclic simultaneity. Now, I've got here musical, geometrical, astronomical, and arithmetical, and I've got tetradic. See, that's the quadrivium, and I'm turning it into a tetrad. You see?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
You sound like you're a little dubious about that yourself.
No, I was mixed up. I thought I said, why they put tetrad? That should be quadrivial. But it should have been. I thought I was looking at the trivial. And it should be quadrivial.
Yeah.
Neither applied. It was there. A tetra. It was actually a clever thing I did. I was just catching up to myself what the hell I meant. It was the tetrad of the four aspects of the quadrivium. No more trivial, as we heard you saying last week. It's at the last gasp of the quadrivials, what's going on here, but it's in a tetradic reality. So I like these statements I'm making. So what am I trying to say? I do that, and then I say, just a minute, I move the thing. So I say, McLuhan explains why people came to deeply identify with whales and dolphins, why Carlos Castaneda's books became popular in the late 60s. Carlos's teachers could change into animals, and why incest became a prevalent phenomenon. So that's me talking about three and four, mainly three. You know, I was just explaining what the art form level was. So
before we leave that, though, let's...
I have one more statement to make about that. So in McLuhan's lecture, something about 2000, he did some place in 74, 75, and I saw it at TV Ontario, the video of it. Did you ever see that or read it? It was actually put into
I have the book.
Right, yeah.
I haven't seen any video associated with it.
Okay. In the video, some smart student gets up and kind of says this. The last word, and it becomes an art form. And then he said, but then there's more of it. And so it's... speed it up, he was saying. And McLuhan says, oh, yes, it's many times over. So that was where I got the idea of Broke Spirals. He was saying that this four-part thing of Gossage was happening fast. And you could say it was just about ideas in the media. The ideas were what people were reacting to. That was the art. That was the... looking for concepts for identity. To make an object was irrelevant. A composition, a movie, a TV show was irrelevant for having an environmental perspective. You just had to see what ideas people were feeling a relevance of and then see the ground of that. So that was really important for me to see that or to interpret it that way. That the art form, so in the Forces interview, the Hydro-Quebec magazine, McLuhan says, the media art forms, he says, it's not baseball, hockey, wrestling, which certain writers of the baby boomer level were getting into. They had gone to Yale and did their book culture, but then they go to New York and they get, quote, corrupted, and they're not into being hoity-toity Gutenberg people, elitists anymore, but they have to be something, so they started celebrating stupid stuff, like wrestling and race car driving. But McLuhan was on to that at the time it was happening, Richard Meltzer was one of these guys who did this, at that time in the early 70s, and McClellan's saying, it's not sport. It's not horse racing. He was naming, you know, cliche working class activities as if they could be what he means by media as art forms. He says it's the media themselves. And that was the turnover of information processing and pattern recognition, which probably gets us into the quote on page 190. In Take Today, he has the quote where art, science, and nature merge through understanding media. You remember that quote?
Yeah.
See, that's – and see that, if you really live with that, you're not welcome in the categories anymore. You won't be able to function in academia. You'd have to become a open an art gallery or start a rock band, which a lot of people would do. A lot of professors, you could say it was modern version of slumming. You know, people went into bohemia in the 20s. Well, in the 70s and 80s, literate professors would have an identity crisis, and they would get involved in modern arts. Croker did that. He formed a punk band, you know, yep. And he was a political economist. What was I saying? That was an attempt to, doing that was trying to respond to the each new pattern every 12 months. As things unfolded and flipped, new fads happened, or trends, but to react by going into the electronic arts was not the answer. The answer was not to do, was to do nothing, which is what you say. You're not impressed with columnists or commentators or artists or anybody, right? I've heard you say that.
All of those things need to be understood, but once you consolidate identity, which is what you're talking about, once you consolidate identity, then you have the problem that it inevitably turns into cliche, in which case it's no longer identity. And so then, as you show in these, in this list, which I take to be cyclic simultaneity, not linearity.
Right.
These things are in dynamic interaction.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about, what people were trying to find in the 70s and 80s, was a way of finding themselves at home in a world that was going faster and faster and denying their old ways of having an identity.
Yeah, they didn't even know what a home was anymore.
Correct. However, what you've described is people, in spite of that, what they're trying to do is find some identity as if this were still possible.
Yeah.
Right?
Nobody
so
was giving that up. Nobody was going to give that up.
Right. But that's unfortunate because if you can't give that up, and which is what McLuhan called being value-free, then you really can't analyze what's going on.
Right, and that's where...
All things need to be understood equally, you could say.
Well, in Interior Landscape, he says the artist becomes all things. And the artist, with the atomic bomb, it's a big attack on the artist's ego. You couldn't be an artist in the Hemingway, James Joyce method anymore. And Finnegan, we don't know how much Joyce understood that, but his book tells you that, Finnegan's Wake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's the correct statement.
No, Joyce understood that very well by making fun of himself.
Yeah.
In not only in Finnegan's Wake, but especially in Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
It's Sean is the writer, isn't he?
Yep.
No,
Shem's the writer. Shem's the writer.
So Shem the postman, is that?
No, it's Sean the postman. He's the respectable son the clean living son, and Shem, the writer, is the guy, you know, putting shit on his arms.
Right. And that's Joyce commenting on himself the vocation of the writer, right?
Yeah. But it's even more complicated. That's what the new criticism gets into, how it flips. He's Shem, Sean, he's his father, he's Issy. It's all mixed up.
HCE.
Yeah. HC bodies. Here comes the bodies. It's Dobbsian, right? HCB.
Well, we'll see. That's what we're getting into.
Yeah, yeah. So, but
let me just say that these, the phrase cyclic simultaneity is an excellent phrase.
Yeah.
And in order to understand what's going on with the trivial and quadrivial here, all of these last word cliche art form and archetype need to be seen in dynamic interaction.
Yep.
So it's each of them gives birth to the others, and the analysis.
That's what I meant by tetradic. The four quadrivial aspects interplay like a tetrad.
Yeah.
That's what I meant by that. Now, cyclic simultaneity, I got from Eric's PhD. He used that phrase somewhere in the book in his Explaining Finnings Wake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll give him kudos. You know, he said it. That's where I got it.
You're talking about Ten Thunders, or you're talking about the PhD?
The PhD, which is, you know, better. The book is okay, but there's 100 pages on the history of manipulating satire in the PhD, which is not in the book.
Yeah.
The Roll of Thunder book in 97. So I don't know how people would get, you know, do you write to Andrew? Because you had to write to Eric to get the PhD. You had to get him to sign off on it. And you're not getting the full understanding unless you read the PhD.
Yeah, that could be. I haven't read the PhD. I just know something about it.
Yeah.
Secondhand.
Well, the...
Probably through Andrew, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if Andrew knows that, but someone's got to tell him, see if he knows about it, and then maybe he'll be make himself available to do it. But the history of manipulating satire is brilliant. It goes through all the phases, you know, 2,000 years of it, and gets up to today. But all you get in his hardcover text is 10 pages or something, very brief. It doesn't give the history. And he takes on all the different literary critics and historians through the centuries who talk about it. It was called Veronian satire like 300 years ago. Dryden retrieved it and called it Veronian because they only knew about it from Varro, who wrote about Menippus. There was nothing much from Menippus. So it's very important to get the history of manipulating satire and why it changed. And the standard encyclopedic or dictionary definitions is not accurate. It's generally, maybe today, it's a little more up to date, but back then, 40 years ago, it was a satire on the philosopher, satire on ideas. So it would sort of imply there was a lot of ideas in these satires, and they were making fun of people who thought ideas, which, you know, that's Gutenbergian. It doesn't get into what's satirized in the 20th century, which is what Joyce, Lewis, and Pound were working on, to update manipulating satire, change it.
Sure. Well, you can. That fits into last word cliche and art form, right?
Would you say that fits?
The last form are philosophical ideas. The cliche is seeing that there's something comical about them all.
Yeah.
And the art form is an attempt to deal with that comedy.
Yeah. And maybe, you see, I always remember, I think I've told this a couple of times, when I sat in an Eric's class at the Art College of Ontario, some kid asked him, what's manipulating satire? And he said, you see that bum that sits out in front of the Art College? He sat there, you know, shitting and eating by the entrance to the hoity-toity museum. And he said, that's a Menippean satire. And they had the philosophy of cynicism. So he had to, he said, this bum sitting there being a problem, he was probably removed after a week or two, right, and arrested or something, or killed or dumped into a homeless place, and then he died. That was a Menippean satire, a satirist. So the kid said, what? you're talking about that bum? It was a shock how Eric defined it. But it was useful to hear that. Now, why am I saying that? What were you just saying that made me want to tell you that point? I guess the art form, the retrieval, that's what the retrieval is. You're a bum. You're not interested in any civilized behavior. That's what.
Well, that's one form.
Yeah.
The retrieval takes.
The retrieval
takes many different forms.
Yeah, and retrievals are often obsolete. They're better than the cliches, but they aren't dealing with the present.
That's right. That shows the cyclic simultaneity of this.
Yeah.
The art forms purport to deal with the problem of the last word transforming into the cliche.
Yeah.
But the art form then becomes a form of the last word, which transforms into cliche. And so you have this dynamic going on.
And archetype. You have to include the archetype.
Yeah, well, then the archetype is an attempt. It too, falls into that same hurdy-gurdy, you could say, because it attempts at a higher level to understand what's going on the trivial level. But its understanding becomes one type of last word, right? And so it just goes into the cycle of archetype to last word to cliche, to cliche to art form to archetype.
Yeah, so by the 70s, McLuhan is bypassing cliche and art form and saying from cliche to bypassing last word and art form by saying from cliche to archetype. It speeds up. That's how I took the title. But I didn't know that's what he meant until I saw that video 5 years later in 75 where he talked about the turning over of this process, every 12 months.
Right.
So, yeah, so then the last word, the cliche and the art form and the archetype all blur. And then you get into maybe the Jeff Koons world where people put anything in the museum, right? And that's where people didn't like art anymore, but they didn't know where to find value. They were looking for value, for an identity, and a lot of the society went into the Bible, went into fundamentalism across the planet. The final archetype of identity was to retrieve religion, which McLuhan said in that dialogue with Muggeridge and Mailer and Fulford in 68, the TV panel. He says, we're moving into a great religious age. And that's what was happening. People were going to hoik up all the old religions as protection, as an identity thing, and it wouldn't work. And McLuhan knew it wouldn't work, so he was trying to figure out how to save the Christian function, but not falling for what everybody else thought was what you do to be a Christian.
Right. So if you see through all of the fundamentalisms, then you have a kind of dynamic of ground.
Yeah.
Right? All of that fits with what we're talking about, because the fundamentalisms are purported last words.
Yes.
That's exactly what they are, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
As soon as you see that the fundamentalisms are plural, then they become a cliche, because the last word can never be plural. It has to be singular.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so it's your singularity.
Yes. So then what McLuhan is trying to do is McLuhan is trying to show that religion is not a singular last word. It's what gets precipitated out of the dynamic of last words, plural.
Yep. So you then, if you fully get that, you can't fit in anywheres. You can disguise yourself and pretend you're fitting in, but you actually are in a new, you're in the silent sea. And
yes,
it's very hard for you to tell people what we're talking about.
Right. That's the problem of all problems.
Yeah.
Right? Because McLuhan was very far from being the only person or the first person that saw this stuff. But he was a person who took very seriously the problem of communicating it.
Yeah.
And at least so far, he also failed.
Yes.
But he may have a future promise. The reason that we're talking about him is that we don't think the last word has been said about McLuhan.
Yes. Yeah, he was, well, he had the virus more than anybody. So we had to figure out what the virus was. You had to understand McLuhan. You get that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, virus means problem. He really saw the problems that nobody would knew how to talk about. He did, but nobody could believe it. What he
right.
was saying. What was that? That joke? Doc, your diagnosis is completely different from anybody else. And then the doc says, "Yeah, but the autopsy will bear me out."
Yeah.
It was great how McLuhan would find jokes that really expressed his situation. He'd find really good jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But what were we going to say?
Well, I'm trying to find a way to say it that I don't know that I would say that McLuhan had the virus. I would say that McLuhan found a way to see through the viruses, but. He wasn't able to communicate how he did it or why somebody should take the trouble to understand how he did it.
That's why in 68, the new discovery of the 20th century was the exploration of pain. That's him knowing how to handle the virus. It was painful, and that was the new probing. So he would say in interviews, I'm not interested in being happy. That's silly. You know, I'm not going to try to be happy. I got to deal with this issue, which goes beyond those sentiments, and I'm exploring pain.
Yeah. So I'm beginning, especially just before 1960, when he started to have blackouts, when he started to realize that his health might not permit him to live to see what he wanted to achieve. Then, as expressed in that, was it Prospect or Project? What was the essay in 62 he did for the art magazine?
Yeah, Prospect.
Prospect, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pain in that.
Yeah.
And really, in the last two decades of his life, when he was being serious, which he wasn't always being, of course, then there's a marked tone of pain to what he's talking about, for
yeah.
sure. And, of course, for a religious person like McLuhan, a Catholic, pain is not something sort of aside from the ground of things. It's pain is built into the ground of things as a sort of a fundamental
yep.
discontinuity.
On the Medium is a Message album, someone says the medium is the message, and McLuhan goes, "Yay!" A very unenthusiastic yay. Do you know that part?
No.
Yeah, you listen to it.
I've heard it, but I don't remember at the moment.
But you know, he's just being friendly, emphatic, and going like he's in pain. There's nothing to be going yay about, but he can't be bothered to explain it to them.
Right. Well, he knows that people are adopting and adapting his language, but in a way that doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a painful realization itself.
Yeah, it's pretty alienating, I assume, to be that isolated.
Absolutely.
I think he has interior landscape. He talks about Baudelaire having great humility before the problem that he was seeing as an early poet, Manipian, whatever he was, exploring the urban landscapes, the new nature. But it's very important the way he writes. He's saying Baudelaire explored his pain with great humility.
That's a wonderful phrase.
Yeah, yeah. And I knew that, and that's what McLuhan did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if we ask, what does humility mean in that context? One of the things it means is allowing the pain to be pain.
Yeah.
Not trying to trump it, not trying to put it in your pocket, allowing yourself to be smaller than it. That's the humility before pain.
Yeah, there's a great respect for it. Like, you've actually broken into the silent sea. It's not a smug silence. It's a painful silence. It's like, holy shit, we got a big problem here, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say a lot of my life was dealing with that. Don't know. I can't say I saw it more intensely than you. I can't compare myself. But I knew I saw the issue because I found that nobody was talking about it correctly.
Uh-huh.
Even around the McLuhan scene.
Yes, I think I understand what you're talking about. When I had...
I don't know if you had it in the 1970s, but you got it now. you got there.
Well, certain. I was going to talk about a time earlier than that. In 1965, my junior year advisor was T.S. Kuhn, Structure of Scientific Revolution.
Yeah, important
and
guy.
I remember talking to him about... how I thought it was important, even for science, to recognize a kind of shadow, a kind of darkness that is present in scientific discovery. And I didn't really know what I was talking about. I was talking about something that I wanted to kind of research or something.
Where did you get the notion that there was such a thing?
Well, I was very interested in those days in Nietzsche, in Camus' book, The Fall, La Chute. I had the notion that I was kind of dislocated from the truisms that I had grown up with before then.
Yeah, so it was like you wanted to do a thesis on darkness, on beyond academia, beyond what academics would think would be a range of stuff that a student would be interested in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But not that I had any great insight.
Right.
It was just a numb feeling that something was not being attended to in the world, but also in my own self. And if I didn't figure out how to deal with that, then I would be screwed. I wouldn't have direction.
Right. So what did Kuhn say?
Well, he just sort of dismissed it. He probably thought that I was too immature I was, what, 18 or
yeah, you were, 19. You like heard some older guy saying it. You were imitating some older guy or something.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he was kind enough to say, you know, can you explain some of that and sort of to listen for a while. But then he just got tired of, you know, hearing a junior in college talk about stuff that he knew was much more complicated than I had any awareness of.
So you didn't do the paper? Like, what did you do? You ended up at McLuhan's in 1970 or so, 69.
Sure. But that was just, that was all part of, I didn't let the problem go. And you could say I'm still gnawing away at it to this day.
Yeah, but you were asking to have an acceptable master or BA or whatever the hell you call it, a thesis. Did you do one at Princeton?
Yeah, I wrote my thesis on Nietzsche.
So you did it. You did get.
And
did.
So, my thesis just doesn't come to a conclusion. It just says that this is the question. What we have been calling the cul-de-sac. I was conscious of then. That would have been 1965, here we are 55 years later.
Right, but you went to McLuhan, and he didn't seem to understand your thesis, your theme, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, either he didn't understand it or he understood it too well.
Yeah.
He may have thought, well, this guy's, completely book-oriented, a conceptualist. I don't want to have anything to do with him.
Yeah.
But McLuhan in those days, he was still suffering from the sequelae of his operation.
Yeah.
And he was famous for taking either an instant like or dislike to people.
Yeah.
And in my case, I just thought, well, he's not listening to me. He's not interested in me. And I'm certainly not interested in the stuff that he's doing in the seminars I attended.
Right.
And so I just took my leave.
So where did you go? Where did that lead to you? Did you go do postgraduate somewhere?
Yeah, I went to, I ended up going to the University of Alberta, and I did that because University of Alberta in those days, I don't know if it's still true, had year-long courses in individual thinkers. And I was really attracted to that.
So did you run into Sheila Watson?
I didn't run into her, but, you know, people were talking about her. I had friends in the English department, I don't think I really knew in those days what she was doing with McLuhan.
Right. Did you know about Wyndham Lewis, stuff like that?
No, at that time, no. Although I had actually been given Time and Western Man as a present, but I had never read it.
So how many years was that out in Alberta? 5 years?
No, I got a Canada Council scholarship in my second year to study in Germany. And so I went over and studied in Germany, and then I had started my PhD at Alberta, but I never went back to finish it.
So what, in Germany you were able to get the original texts of Nietzsche and everybody? The European continental thinking?
How do you mean get? You mean get the books or
you
get enough of the language?
Classes,
to
have classes in it and study it.
Yes, but really my I didn't know any German when I first went there.
Mm.
And so for the first year, all I was doing was learning basic German.
Yeah.
And I didn't know German well enough to really understand the great German writers for another 20 years after that.
You did eventually get to know German well enough to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. So what did you do in, say, from 75 to 90?
I was an entrepreneur.
In what?
I was developing a small business. I had a software company in Los Angeles that when small computers were first coming out. And
so you got into the computer world.
Yes.
And
stupidly, I didn't become a multimillionaire in the process. I remember very well when Microsoft was when the shares of Microsoft were first floated, and they came out at $29, and myself and all my brilliant friends thought that that was ridiculously overvalued. But if we bought 100 of the things then and held them,
holy shit,
we'd be multimillionaires now.
So that was stupid. But were you in the States because you had married the American?
No, I was in the States because my parents had retired to Palm Springs, and my father got sick, and I was the only one of our kids that didn't have a job with a fixed abode.
Yeah.
So I was able to come down here then.
So, well, how were you able to stay there without a visa and all that?
Oh, my parents had become dual citizens.
Oh, okay.
And so I was able to get my green card automatically.
So you were in California in the glory days, 70s and early 80s.
Yes, sir.
That's neat.
Yeah, it was neat. It was being in Los Angeles in the 70s and early 80s was a great experience.
I was doing it all the time. We were always there. And you know who else was always there? McLuhan, visiting Mary.
You mentioned that before.
Yeah, he would get there, try to get there as much as possible. Because of the excitement of the place, and he would make up bullshit like, "Oh, I got to go do a lecture," but he wasn't doing one. He just wanted to get into the L.A. environment and meet people, and that's how he met David whatever, the guy who did the final, tried to do the final TV series with him. Forget his last name. He lives here in Maui. David Greenberg.
Greenberg, I was going to say.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But L.A. was more vibrant than New York in that period. And that's why it's in the Croker quadrant, Lemurian quadrant on my chart. It's the beginning of the virtual society and the excitement of that. So, you know, that was all delusion, but it was no doubt everybody was moving to L.A. And the movie that Marshall was in, Annie Hall, was about that. That's what the movie was about. L.A. versus New York. Woody Allen, the book guy, versus Tim Leary. And Leary wrote about it. He, in his books, after he got out of jail in 76, he said, you know, I ain't no Woody Allen. Woody Allen's a New York fuddy-duddy. And I'm, you know, multi-consciousness, multi-leveled shaman. So, and then he became very popular with Jack Nicholson and everybody.
Yeah.
And Mary was in the middle of that scene.
Yeah, well, that was also the years of the birth of punk.
Yeah,
and the everything that was going on was sort of a commentary on what else was going on.
Yeah, everything was meta.
Yes.
So did you go to Venice Beach or Santa Monica? Where we might have walked by each other?
It's possible. It's
yeah.
possible. Sure. I mean, in those days, it was still possible to take a car across Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Right? It's no longer possible. Everything's all jammed up.
Yeah.
But, I never lived in Santa Monica or Venice, but at one time I explored the possibility of living in Santa Monica. I thought that would be neat, but I couldn't find the place that would work financially.
Right. So where did you live? What part?
I lived in Los Feliz, and then later I lived in the fringe of Beverly Hills.
You mean Westwood?
No, the other direction.
Echo Park,
east,
is it?
On the east. Well, no.
Silver
no,
Lake?
I mean, well, those are all great districts, but they're not near to Beverly Hills.
So what's in between Beverly Hills and Silver Lake, the Laurel
Los
Canyon?
Los Angeles. No. Yeah, I mean, Beverly Hills is its own little town, right? You know,
yeah.
There's satellite towns all over the place.
Yes.
Well, Silver Lake is part of Los Angeles, so it's not an independent place. But BH is probably, I don't know, 15 miles maybe from Silver Lake. And it's all Los Angeles. It's all
that goes down into what?
Midtown. Well, that's to the south.
Yeah.
If you go west from Beverly Hills, you go into West Hollywood. You go into Fairfax. You go into Mid Wilshire. You go into Koreatown.
Yeah, I know Fairfax.
That's
where Dave
yeah.
Worster lived. That's right.
All right.
We would go over to Fairfax. So what did you do? What was your social world? Your business life?
I guess so. But, you know, I was always doing what I consider my work. Trying to articulate what the cul-de-sac is and how it's possible to extricate ourselves out of it. So, you know, I've been working on that problem for 55 or 60 years, and it was always my main business. So what I was doing, to earn money was always secondary.
Well, did you go back to school at any point in the 80s and early 90s?
Yeah, in the mid-80s, I went back to Loyola Chicago briefly because they had John Salas was there, who is a leading academic interpreter of continental philosophy, and especially of Heidegger. And so I wanted to study Heidegger with John, and I did, but I really couldn't breathe in an academic atmosphere, so I gave that up.
So that's when you lived in Chicago with your wife, right?
Yes. Well, I went from L.A. over to Chicago, and actually I was living in Chicago when I met my wife.
Yeah, then you end up back in California eventually.
Yeah, well, with a detour, we lived not far from Princeton for almost 15 years in the middle of New Jersey, and then...
Well, that's when we met you at the end of that period, 98.
Correct. And then back to Chicago briefly, and then back to L.A. So I sort of did a circuit, L.A., Chicago, New York, Chicago, L.A.
And if Sanderson had worked out, that would have been a whole new world for you. You would have got somewhere of that level with his project, right? Digitizing.
Well, I still, I think I have at least partially fulfilled that project.
Yeah.
We don't have proper digital access to all of McLuhan's stuff, which in my mind should include his papers in Ottawa. But I've spent, a decade trying to explicate different aspects of his work. And I'm pretty sure that in the future, a lot of PhDs will start with stuff that I've exposed in my blog and then they'll do a whole thesis
on
that topic.
So when did you get into the digital company that you and George were going to do the McLuhan thing within?
That would have been in the 90s.
Mid-90s?
In the mid-90s,
yeah.
And then, so I did that for 15 or so years. And I still own part of that company, but I'm retired from active work in it.
You own part of the company?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Was George an owner?
No.
Okay, so here's the big news. I have some big news. I just found out this today. Clinton told me that starting on Saturday, Andrew at the McLuhan Institute, you know, the grandson, he found a stash of tapes that Eric hid from everybody of all the Monday night seminars starting around 1972.
Wow.
And he's going to start playing them every Saturday night.
Huh. Okay, good.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
And
I was the most... I was the most regular attender of it all. It's going to be interesting for me what I remember, what I hear. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It'll be interesting to know just how chaotic the recordings are.
Right. You mean the content?
No. I mean the recordings themselves. If there were transcriptions. To my way of thinking, that would give a better sort of grasp into the recordings themselves rather than the other way around.
Yeah, but I want to hear McLuhan, you know, his voice and arguing with Frank Zingroni and all the regular people there. They didn't have a clue what he was talking about. It was going to be funny.
But you're going to have to wade through a tremendous amount of dreck.
I've done that
too.
I've dealt with the pain of that for years.
Uh-huh.
You know, it seemed the humility of the pain. That's why I was so patient on the radio. I was known as a very patient person who would listen to idiots for a long time and not seem to be bothered because I didn't have a point of view.
Right.
I didn't have something to defend. I was really saying, okay, let's hear what people say about what they think is going on. That was my laboratory.
Sure. That's what we were talking about earlier, actually, is if you don't have an investment in ideas, then you can relate to anything and you can analyze anything.
Yeah.
But the great trick is when people lose their grasp, in most cases, that feels threatening.
Yeah.
People, the whole trick is to find identity in instability.
Yeah. And I don't know what enables a person to do that. I don't know if it can be taught. Maybe it can be an example, but...
Well, that's in our conversations, that's what I've said is the great problem of the tradition.
Yeah.
And Plato already knew about it. That's the whole problem of dialectic. The problem of dialectic isn't dialectical. The problem of dialectic is to lead somebody from one set of ideas that they are accustomed to into a new set of ideas.
Yeah.
And in between that is a gap. And how to navigate the gap is the great question.
Right. So let's look at this quote here, important quote on page 190, the last page of War and Peace in the Global Village. And so I think I said what I wanted to say about the interaction of the last word, cliche, art form, archetype. I think we've done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's something that nobody points out. You know, there's no McLuhan scholar laid out those four things. I don't know. Did you do it somewhere?
No, not like that.
Yeah. So that's new.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to look at what was going on with McLuhan. I'm trying to show how he was faced with this kind of transition in, let's say, 1952, in that era, 51 to 53, when he was seeing through the literary mindset and realizing that that was limited and that he himself had been limited. And so he was trying to feel his way into something different.
Yeah, that's where he saw through Pound. That was the big change. That was a big influence for him, interacting with Pound.
Oh, absolutely. But I don't think he saw, when you say saw through, do you mean saw limitations
to
Pound?
Yeah, what you were just saying, how he saw the limitations in the Gutenberg Galaxy, Pound was the figure for him to discover that through.
Well, I'd have to think about that, but off the top of my head, I would disagree. I think Pound was a positive influence at that time.
Well, that's right. I'm saying it's a that was a dramatic. He wouldn't have become mature if he hadn't met Pound.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But aren't you saying that he had to go beyond that influence? He had to see through Pound taking see through in a negative fashion, or are you saying see through in a positive fashion where he would be putting Pound on?
Well, he says it in his letter to Pound. I think it's the June 52 letter where he says, you guys, the men of 1914, were dealing with the power of words. But I'm dealing with a time where the word now is a drug. See,
right.
Very different situation.
Yeah.
You know,
I shouldn't have interrupted.
No, you said you think that's a...
I think that's the 51, that's one of the 51 letters. And then in 52, what he says to Pound is that, look, you and Yeats and Joyce and Eliot have been using these liturgies to shape your artwork, and I didn't know this before, and it kind of pisses me off that I didn't.
Right. I think I'm quoting June 22nd, 52, and you're quoting another part of 52 where he's on page 234 in the letters book. He's saying, why didn't you guys tell me this stuff? And no critic should know it. You know, there was that secret society theme that he was working out. On the theme of words, I think that's in June 22nd, 52. Maybe 51.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Well, we at least agree that it's a very important letter.
Oh, yeah. Do you have your letters right there?
Yeah, I'm just pulling it out now.
Yeah, look up the June 22nd. You know, that's where he says he's an intellectual thug. It's a long letter. Look up June 22nd, 52.
There is no June 22nd, 52.
Okay.
There's,
June 22nd, 51, then.
Yeah, well, that's what I think you were thinking about. Yeah, that's June 22, 51 is the – that's why I said I thought it was 51 and not 52.
Right. So that's the long letter where he says an intellectual thug, and does you'll see the word words in italics. Is that in that letter? Might be on the second page.
Well, I mean, he says, how are words to be used to unweave the spell of print? I'm working on that problem with that italicized. The word is now the cheapest and the most universal drug.
Right.
Is that what
That's what I'm talking about. But look at the sentence before where he says, you guys did something with the word.
I think you're thinking about the 62 letter. I don't see anything like that here.
Yeah, he says I'm working on the word as drug, and but he's already stated what they were dealing with words. It was an earlier phase. I don't see why it wouldn't be in that letter, because that's. I always put the two together, and he laid out the two. Just look a few lines up a bit from the
drug. Oh, I am. That's where he talks about Lewis writing America and the Cosmic Man and how
nobody responded.
He was trying to clear the air of food.
A fug.
And that, I prefer to diffuse that this gigantic human bomb by starting a dialogue somewhere on the sidelines.
Yeah, it might be past that. Do you know where the word FUG comes from?
I thought it was for fuck all.
Yes, it was Mailer used it in his novel, The Naked or something, whatever his novel was after World War II.
Naked and the Dead.
Yeah, and he couldn't say fuck, so he said fug.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume, because it put him on the map, I assume McLuhan read it, or it was part of the slang language anyways, you know?
Yeah, I think the latter.
Yeah. So, he talks about being a thug, and you go over to the next page and go up to the top paragraphs moving down. Like the word as drug, that's on the second page of the letter, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and it's further down. So it would look a little higher to see where he talks about them.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm looking around a lot on this letter, but...
not seeing it.
I'm not seeing that, but I... I think what you're talking about is in a later letter...
Mm.
Where he talks about the liturgies, but I'm having trouble.
You mean the secret societies? That's page 234.
Oh, 235. Yeah, exactly. So
yeah.
Here he talks about, doesn't make me any happier to know that Joyce, Lewis, Eliot, and yourself have used these rituals as a basis for art activity.
Yeah.
Now, that's not what you're talking about?
No. He says they dealt with the word as, it was a new idea. Kinner writes about it in the Pound Era. They discovered the role of language in a new, more expanded way. And I would say the electric environment brought back the word as an art form. And linguistics got going, you know, Saussure and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But Pound and Joyce were looking at it more aesthetically or whatever, I don't know, whatever you call it, poetically. But they were looking at, they were sort of getting the insight that everything was a word. All artifacts were words. So they were retrieving the pre-Newton, pre-Descartes vitality of the word as a living organism. That
Correct.
Is McLuhan's PhD theme.
Except that what he's seeing at this time is that remaining at the level of the literary doesn't work.
Yeah.
The level of the literary is the Gutenberg galaxy.
The Gutenberg galaxy was now a drug.
That's right. But he recognizes that he had been drugged out on
it. Yeah, yep.
So he was seeing through himself, and at the same time, he was seeing through his heroes.
That's right. So, he actually broke into the Silent Sea at that point. That's where he was seeing something no one else of his generation was seeing.
Maybe. What the way I would formulate it is I would say that at that time he recognized that what he had done previously was only literature, was only epistemology.
Yeah.
And that he had to go into ontology. And the problem that he then saw was that ontology is not singular but plural, and to communicate that, people had to learn how to navigate the gap between ontologies.
And also he's processing Carpenter's Eskimo knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big...
There's a whole bunch of things that are going on in his life at that point.
Yeah.
Cybernetics. He's communicating with Norbert Wiener.
Well, look at it this way. He's got Don Thiel bringing Wiener to him. He's got Carpenter bringing Eskimo reality to him. He's got Innes doing his stuff, and he's dealing with Pound. Maybe there's a tetrad in there. Is there anybody else?
Oh, Joyce. Yeah, Joyce is very important to him.
Right. That's what Thiel. Thiel brings cybernetics and Joyce, and they start.
Yeah, if you listen to Thiel, that's the way it works.
No, Thiel. they started to do a little reading club of Finning His Wake.
Yeah, right. But that he was getting a lot of Joyce from Kenner, right? Kenner would write his PhD on Joyce right at that time, and they were intensely involved with each other. And McLuhan was doing his own research into Joyce.
And Lewis.
And as regards cybernetics and stuff, maybe Thiel thinks that he introduced McLuhan to that, but I'm not so sure that that's true.
Thiel introduced the cybernetics to him. He didn't know about that. I have Thiel's copy of The Social Communication, Carl Deutsch and maybe Bateson, that book.
Not Deutsch and Bateson, somebody else in Bateson. But I know the book you're talking about.
Yeah, Heubsch maybe, H-E-U-B or something, rather than Deutsch. But I have... it has McLuhan's annotations in it. So I think it's Don's copy lent to McLuhan. McLuhan read it and made annotations in it, gave it back to Don, and then I got it from Don. You know, it's a pretty important book.
Sure.
I think it's, Psychiatry or Communication, The Social Matrix of Psychiatry? Is that the title of it?
I think it might be called The Social Matrix of Communication.
Right. And then I go to the Innes letter, March 51.
Yeah.
He mentions, the book.
He mentions Deutsch in that letter.
No, I don't see it there. The fallacy in the Deutsch-Wiener approach. Footnote 7, the human use of human beings. But footnote 6, Carl Deutsch, Communication and Self-Governing Organization, Notes on Autonomy and Human Authority and the Growth of Social Groups.
I've got a post on that. It's the footnote is mistaken.
Is that right?
Yeah. The you see, the whole
You're
notion
blipping
about...
Out.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
No.
No?
Reconnect.
Hello?
Yeah, I can barely hear you. So
it's on...
Fix your mic or something.
How's that?
Starting to get better. Keep going.
Okay. The the story of McLuhan and cybernetics is quite complicated. And one of the things that people have to understand is that Siegfried Gideon was a guest lecturer at MIT in 1950. And McLuhan and Gideon were in touch, and Gideon was the guy that sent McLuhan Deutsch's essay.
Mm.
And I forget exactly the title of the essay that Gideon sent McLuhan, but it was published in 1948 in a collection, and the off-print is still to be found in the Gideon papers in Zurich.
Mm.
So what that does is it shows that the footnote is not quite correct in the letters, but it also means that we have to rethink the Thiel, you know, introduction of cybernetics to McLuhan, seeming a little bit. McLuhan was usually out ahead of other people, and other people could not really appreciate what was going on with McLuhan.
Yeah, so he kept it to himself, or he was forced to keep it to himself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I think the Deutsch thing I'm thinking of is in Interior Landscape, the first Joyce essay. I think he quotes the communication matrix. If you have that right there, you'll see it.
No, I don't have it. But I think you mean the Bateson book, Bateson quotation, not a Deutsch.
Yeah, Bateson and Hobbes or Deutsch. Bateson and somebody else.
Yeah, not Deutsch. But, I know that he does quote Bateson there, and he also quotes Bateson in a letter at the time. But then, as far as I know, he didn't follow Bateson's work.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I'm looking at page 227, the June 22nd, 51 letter, and he says, I am not of the we party. I should prefer to defuse this gigantic human bomb by starting a dialogue somewhere on the sidelines to distract the triggermen or to needle the somnambulist. So you read that. And he says, In London, 1910, you faced various undesirable states of mind. Since then, the word has been used to effect a universal hypnosis. So I remember now, I filled in what Kenner said in the Pound era about how Pound and them discovered the word. Now, they did it. That was the antidote to undesirable states of mind, which was Gutenberg minds. That's why I always thought there was a statement about words about the men of 1914, but it's not in here. It's in Kenner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because then he goes, since then the word has been used to effect a universal hypnosis. How are words to be used to unweave the spell of print, of radio commercials and newscasts? I'm working on that problem. The word is now the cheapest, most universal drug. So that's a very important statement there.
Absolutely. It's where we are right today.
Yeah. And the next paragraph, too. We're inside the machine. The machine's inside us. Our problem is tougher. I think that's what he's saying. There's where he's saying, seeing through Pound in them. He's trying to tell him, I'm into some problem that you may not be aware of.
Maybe.
You know,
maybe.
And then,
he certainly says that the next year. So this may be the first intimation of that.
Yeah. And he, he gives the outline for the Gutenberg Galaxy, and he gets no response from Pound. Pound says, nuts. That's nuts. You know, remember that part?
Yeah, of course.
I think that's in the letters here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So asks if Pound can understand sort of the history of media.
Yeah.
That's what is the question that he's asking Pound. And it's a little bit unclear what exactly Pound thought was nuts.
Yes. And
right?
I think that this is when Carpenter, Thiel, and he are starting to think about applying to the Ford Foundation. That's what this, the end of the Gutenberg era, is a summary of what's going to be in their proposal to the Ford Foundation.
Yes, I think that's the case. But it's more in the background of their application.
Right? Yeah.
Their application is intended to awake memories of Innes more than get into the history of that McLuhan would later set out.
So when I turn the page, you know, he lays out, you know, radio, TV, cinema, radio, telephone. But then he says, since Rambo, the newspaper as landscape enters all the arts. With landscape comes necessary musical adjustment of all parts of poetic composition. There's the music.
Right.
Juxtaposition
right.
of forces in field rather than continuous statement. With mechanization of speech and gesture and swamping with visual auditory matter, after print-created drought, we come to the age of semi-literacy at best. You could say this in 100 words, but are there some big facts I've missed? Of course, I'm interested in the serious mag. Mencken discovered the only real audience in America was on the American campus, the undergraduate. He's still there, but nobody since Mencken has reached him. You have to have a program for the undergrad, some icon smashing plus a real bogeyman. For latter, in place of Babbitt, I suggest the bureaucrat, both inside government and big business. He is the new Babbitt. His ways are worth study. For example, Fortune magazine, October, November 51, an article called Wives in Management. He goes, honey. We'll get back to other points in your letter when I get a chance to in a day or so.
Right.
So let's go to the quote here in War and Peace in the Global Village. So he says, the biologists use two other categories that are helpful for perceiving the relation between the end of nature today and the problem of understanding the future of media and technology. They speak of outbreeding and inbreeding. As Mayer puts it, quote, most animals are essentially outbreeders, most microorganisms inbreeders. With electricity, all this has changed totally. At present, the entire mammalian world has become the microorganismic. It is the total, that's partly why I have on my chart the subatomic particles as they were laid out in the mid-80s, including the term demon nuclei. That's the human, the chemical body is microorganismic. It is the total individual cultures of the world, linguistically and politically, that have become the mammals, according to the old classifications of evolutionary hypothesis. It is the cultural habit, it is the cultural habitat in which we have long been accustomed to think that people were contained has now become the mammal itself. That's a really great statement. Now contained in a new macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial kind. That's a pretty complex or interesting statement.
Very complex. Yeah.
Our technologies or self-amputations and the environments or habitats which they create must now become that matrix of that macrocosmic connubial bliss derided by the evolutionist. So I would look for other places where he used the word connubial or connubian. There's not too many others.
No, that's right.
It's a rare word there. And it's an interesting, is it the peace that passeth all understanding, which he changed to the peace that passeth all technology? What is this connubium that's going on, you know? The connubial bliss derided by the evolutionist. Well, that's derided by the linear mind.
Yeah, well, that relates to the last word and cliche that we were just talking about.
Yeah. So what do you think is the part you don't get here in this quote? The connubial part?
I'll specify it for you in a sec. I didn't want to interrupt your reading, but I need to let the dog out the door.
Okay,
here.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I'm just going to walk over there. Let me know if we drop out. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah, I just remember in his essay on Wyndham Lewis in Interior Landscape, that's where he deflates the scientists. He talks about the scientist has a magical formula, retrieves the magic of, you know, tribal societies. So the scientist has a formula and puts on the world with that, and the artist can't handle the blow to his ego from the atomic bomb. That's your science and art being deflated.
Yeah. So last word going to cliche.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The last word, the latest great artist, immediately is a cliche. So then Warhol says, you know, everybody's famous for 15 minutes. And they say that he got that by reading McLuhan. That's what he came up with in his translation of what he thought McLuhan was saying. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Yeah, no. I think they even have it in the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, wherever it is. Saw somebody.
Could be. I have a post on Warhol taking his 15 minutes of fame directly from McLuhan.
Yeah, you talk about that, you're saying.
Yeah.
So you're citing something that maybe I'm citing?
What I do is I show that McLuhan knew in the early 60s that fame could be manufactured. And so I show his relationship with Gossage has been possibly misconceived. Usually it's presented as if Gossage was the expert on fame and was able to deliver fame to McLuhan. And I think McLuhan had the insight into fame and was able to use Gossage to get it.
So
maybe I misunderstood what you were just saying when you asked me if I knew anything about what you were talking about, and I said no. Maybe I should have said yes.
Yeah. The Ion said that McLuhan went for Gossage the way you were describing because he was getting pressure from Corinne. Corinne was sick of the whole stupid academic world. She had bigger ambitions. And she probably realized he could go further. So she was saying, you fucking get to do something here or I'm gone. Which would be pretty shocking to hear the family respond to that. But anyways, Ion's pretty cold. It sees what's going on and says stuff. And that's what he
said.
Well,
it certainly may be true that she may have supported his extra academic voyage. She may have given him the confidence to do it. She may have told him that he was certainly capable of it. She may have pointed out how their mutual friend, Muller-Thien, had done something of the sort. So I would imagine that she played an important role. I wouldn't describe it as you say Ion has, but that she was his backbone, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Mm. Okay. So then underneath the quote, you have me translating it. So I'm saying it to this person, and then we transcribe it. Basically, people started to identify with animals because the animal kingdom, which was traditionally separate from humans, merged with humans and all of nature, now subsumed into the second nature, which was technology. We started to think the animals were similar to us. We were all in the same boat inside the technological matrix, second nature. Technology became the outbreeder, whereas before animals were the outbreeders and humans were inbreeders. But then the mammals and humans both became paranoid inbreeders while technology became the outbreeder. That's the last page, War and Peace and Global Village. That's important. That's increasingly from the 60s on, people kept saying, the media, you got to blame the media. And I say the media for people was the news. And this was the news containing all languages and cultures outbreeding on people. And this is what people gradually got alienated by in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, is the technology becoming an outbreeder and basically swallowing the little microorganisms of humans.
So I understand what you're saying there, but I don't understand its connection with alienation. You seem to be saying that there's a process that at once engulfs and alienates. And I can see how those potentially go together, but I don't know how you're intending it.
Well, he's saying the outbreeder is media. They're the new animals. That's a title of a song on the Bosmian Ecology album that I came up with. New animals waving goodbye. There was constantly new animals being made, new media trends, which is what we start off talking about. The process of whatever the trend pattern was that people thought, where he would call it the where it was at syndrome, right? So people kept trying to find out where it was at. That was them reacting to the outbreeding. Then the next thing is it flips with the internet. People start to, in a way, become the outbreeders. They were able to swallow analog media and become more and more super angels and gods, making their own spaces, which definitely came in with the Web 2.0. So
let's just, before we go too far, let's just talk about outbreeding and inbreeding, and especially the quotation, most animals are essentially outbreeders, most microorganisms inbreeders. When I read that, I read that a microorganism usually replicates itself by dividing. And so the inbreeders are replicating a certain identity, whereas animals, including humans, are not replicating themselves in that way. They replicate themselves through somebody else or through something else. And that's, from my way of thinking, that's the difference between outbreeders and inbreeders. Is that how you're understanding it as well?
No, but that isn't that reflecting the literate person is inner-driven and the electric person is outer-driven, that the guy who did crowds came up with?
Well, maybe. I mean, what you just said makes sense.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that's what you mean by inbreeders, outbreeders. But I'm thinking of basically a more aggressive thing. The microorganisms are paranoid. They just stay within their little world. And the animals are out wandering around, interacting with other environments.
Okay. I can buy that. I can buy that. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, remember, this is this other guy, Mayer's categories, and McLuhan's hijacking
right.
it for his purposes. But I think it's important to realize that the cultures of the world have become the mammals and the outbreeders. That's just the paranoid vision that all these Silicon Valley guys guys got over the last 30 years. Every now and then one pops up and says, this is horrible. It's out of control. Technology's going to wipe us out. And they quit, right? They disappear. That's them recognizing the media, the cultures of the world, and the technology world becoming outbreeders. They feel alienated. They feel attacked. They think that humans are going to be eaten up.
But to me, that seems to presuppose the value of being an inbreeder.
No.
Why would
inbreeder is a hiding, a negative response, but it's all that you have.
Right.
You know, the entire mammalian world has become microorganismic. That's what people call pollution and the death of animals and lions and stuff. You know, that's people recognizing that the animals are expendable. They become a microorganismic, tiny. That may not be what they mean, but that's how I took it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just trying to understand your reading.
Yeah, it may be different from the way inbreeders is actually meant.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't... I'm not at all trying to be accusatory or critical. I'm just trying to feel my way along because I've never really understood this passage. I've especially not understood why it's almost a culmination of War and Peace.
Yeah. It's the cultural habitat in which we have long been accustomed to think that the people were contained has now become the mammal itself. People used to, in the 80s, say the state became the terrorist. I think that was a perception of the outbreeding. I remember Anna Vaughn at CKLN saying that to me. I was telling him about Mae Brussels, political conspiracies and stuff. And he said, oh, that's when the state becomes, I think he said, a terrorist. And that's more and more what people think is happening, especially now. So this quote's really important because they're perceiving the cultures and media of the world as outbreeders. And people are hiding in their little nuclear families or their religious fundamentalisms, you know, pretty isolated and pretty hopeless and pretty afraid and hoping for some cataclysm to clean up the outbreeders. That's what is the mood in the world right now.
Oh, definitely it's the mood right now. In terms of McLuhan, I kind of thought that by 68, he had moved beyond that kind of criticism. And
That's where you get to the connubial bliss. See,
yeah.
So here's what it is. At the time, in 67, 68, I was hearing from Dave Worster in the channelings of cosmic awareness that Rye, R-H-Y-E-E, which you'll see in my chart, which was the original separateness in consciousness, whatever that is, had set up all the principalities of the world, the elitisms, the priests, and the inner secret societies, that had come to a resolution in 67 when Ralph Doobie died. And he channeled the return of Rai to essence. So this very obscure, almost cultish information is what I came across in 68, 69. And then I was reading this, and that's how I interpreted it. A new macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial kind. In simple terms, that's Rai and the original separateness has gone. And McLuhan kind of says it in 55 when he makes that sentence with the cosmic plane. Remember, he says, this is a major shift on a cosmic level or cosmic plane. You remember that? I think it's in the 5.
I do remember that. And for me, that's very important because I'm always insisting on the plurality of ontologies.
Yeah.
Ontologies are the cosmic plane. And if it can shift, that means it's plural.
If it can shift, that means it's plural, right.
So when he's talking about a new macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial kind.
And connubium means marriage.
Yes, or association, yes.
And so the religious idea of heaven and earth coming together is what this is. Theologically, it's what he's talking about.
I would say what he's talking about is a new sense of identity that doesn't depend upon some variety of inbreeding.
Yeah, it doesn't depend on the separateness.
Okay, but that separateness seen from the outside, inbreeding seen from the inside, is exactly not separate.
Yeah.
Right, it's some kind of fundamental identity.
Yeah, and that's the blindness.
Yeah,
that's where people get into problems there with that. They're seeing things upside down. Mm-hmm. So our technology.
So I think we're coming to an agreement here. I think if I understand your reading. The sentence, it is the cultural habitat that has now become the mammal itself. That is to say, has become the outbreeder.
Yeah.
But
it's contained in a newer environment.
That's right. Catholic McLuhan, what that means is that there is a way of understanding our entire context, our ontological context, that does not depend upon inbreeding. That in that total context, we can imagine outbreeding as being compatible with identity.
Yeah, that's where McLuhan says, you know, in the Burroughs interview, the aware artist becomes an Egyptian pharaoh and programs the whole culture. That's where McLuhan becomes an outbreeder. It's in any environment do the cultures being outbreeders. He finds a way to bypass that, a macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial kind, which creates the connubial bliss macrocosmically. That's the big level he's performing with.
The artist doesn't create that, except in the sense that the artist can make, and as opposed to match, can make an awareness of it as being already there.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's not when contained in a new macrocosm. That's a new macrocosm. Only in the sense that we weren't aware of that before. It's not a new macrocosm in the sense of being produced or manufactured or something like that as new.
Yeah, McLuhan, if people heard him, they could get the pattern, and that solved the situation. You didn't need a movie, an art form, to express it. The core idea of where we'd come to, if it was expressed properly, which he was trying to do, that would be a huge epiphany for people. And
absolutely.
And you could spread that epiphany just by getting on, you know, on 60 Minutes or something. Back then you had access to major millions of people, and they would hear something that they would never hear normally anyways, ever. And anybody might recognize it through their own experience. I think that's true,
but the what was interesting about McLuhan's answer, his epiphany, was that it wouldn't be an idea. It would be something more like science. It would be something that people would work on. So it wouldn't have, you know, some big final answer, some big final dogma or anything. It would be something that people knew was true, but it was not true in a limited sense. It was true in the sense of ongoing investigation, which could go on forever.
Yeah, and the homeopathic implosion that was going on was replaying what the Telegraph started. The connubium, the electrical connubium of a superterrestrial kind, that is what people had to recognize, and they would have problems staying with the recognition, and then all meditations, contemplations, or studies would retrieve it once again at some point. So that's why McLuhan repeated the theme in every book. He wasn't trying to come up with, you know, new novels, new stories. He was trying to say, look at the pattern of where we've come to, that silent sea. And his books would show up every couple of years to remind people of that. And that was the best thing to do. That's how you communicated it.
Right. So there wasn't something linear going on.
Yeah.
And what he had to say was always the same old.
Yep. And, you know, and he was saying it back in the mid-50s.
That's right. That's when he came across it, for sure. At the same time, he didn't know how to communicate it. He didn't know how to say it. And so there was a kind of voyaging going on, but it was a voyaging within the problem.
Yeah.
Within the investigation that was itself the end of all of our exploration, as Eliot says. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's expressed, what we're trying to say is expressed in Take Today more blatantly than previous books. So this
that's
is
right. Well,
this is a statement that's going to be developed in Take Today.
True. He had a better sense of what he was trying to say, and of the problems in trying to say it.
Yeah, and Barry Nevitt was around him for that later phase to be someone who would be a reasonable someone to bounce the ideas off of. Carpenter was not interested in it. He told me that. Carpenter thought everybody was dumb after him. But Harley Parker was alcoholic. And Barry was the guy, pretty well balanced, who could make that book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he was important for McLuhan when there was nobody around anymore.
Yes, I think that's true. I think he was the one guy of the co-authors that was able to bring McLuhan in his best form forward.
Yeah. The other guys couldn't do it. I mean, Harley told me that McLuhan learned everything about art from him. You know, they all made stupid statements. Carpenter made crazy statements.
And that's what I was trying to say earlier about Thiel.
Yeah, no, Thiel was pretty balanced, but Thiel, he didn't like Barry. So I don't think Thiel fully saw the Take Today vision until later, years later, maybe because of his dialogues with me, because I would bring it up, and I didn't feel that he got it. And he did say that he got bogged down dealing with bureaucratic power. He said, I shouldn't have got into that role and ended up president of university. He said, in his own creative development, that was a mistake. It waylaid him, and he didn't. And then when he got out of it, he read MIT Stuart Brand's the MIT Media Lab, whatever it was called. That's when he picked up the McLuhan torch and said, "Okay, the cyber culture is fitting its wake, and this is what McLuhan was saying." And he got a lot of attention in the '90s because of that. He was the he was the first to apply McLuhan's formula to the new media, to the internet, and all that. So. But he could have done it 20 years and probably earlier because he but he got distracted. So he had a problem, which he admitted. Barry was an engineer and was relatively successful and in touch with societies all over the world, you know, the IEE Society, all these different groups of engineers. He was quite well known. He was more balanced, you know. He didn't have an identity crisis like the rest
of them. I think, you put your finger on it there. He was comfortable with himself.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the other people, like Watson, got uptight in relationship with McLuhan.
I forgot about Watson. You've got Watson, Carpenter, Thiel, and Harley Parker. Those are the four guys, right? Is there anybody else in there? The guy who did the computer sensory thresholds, he tried to steal stuff from McLuhan.
Oh, that was ridiculous. Well, that was McLuhan's fault. Or I shouldn't say it was his fault, but he got McLuhan got waylaid into the idea that he could prove his ideas by going down that road, which was ridiculous.
Right, but the point is that was another guy he was very involved with who fell away, like Ralph Baldwin was another one. They all had personal ambitions that they thought McLuhan would, you know, help them leapfrog him into something for themselves. Barry didn't have that so much. Is there anybody else? Who else? Who did he do books with? Quentin Fiore and those guys, they were just New York hustlers, you know. They were...
McLuhan was using them, using their talents, much like he did with Gossage.
Yeah. So the series guys were Carpenter, Harley, Barry Watson, and whoever else, and Daniel Capon, he was the computer guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And Thiel, and maybe one or two other guys we didn't know about, you know, a businessman here or there. Remember there was that businessman guy he really liked, Max somebody or something, in like 64, 65, hit on Corinne? And he had
to
punch the guy.
I remember this.
Yeah, that's in Marchand's book. Another guy was Philip Dean in the early 60s. And you see this in the letters. You know, Carpenter, he told me, he was into the aesthetics. When Marshall started talking about the global thermostat, he said, that's ridiculous. But Barry Nevitt could take that one and play with it. And he has in the ABC of Prophecy a 10-point program, which is pretty good. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Do you have his books?
I have one or two.
Yeah, look at the back of ABC of Prophecy where he lays out... his 10-point program. I think it's 10 points. Very interesting. He takes on every discipline and shows, you know, what's the obsolete part and what's the new part.
For my taste, in his own books and essays, Barry's too schematic, too classificatory for McLuhan.
That's true, but somebody had to do it. If you didn't read Barry, you didn't know that was what McLuhan was saying. You probably wouldn't get that far. Barry spelled out the later systematic part of McLuhan.
But that's, you wouldn't get a part of what McLuhan was saying.
Yeah. Yeah,
right?
Important
this
part.
This was not all of, you would, this was not at all. Everything McLuhan was saying. So there was a translation going on that left out huge parts of Barry was feeling the elephant, but he was only able to feel parts of it.
Yeah, the other guy who couldn't take it was Morris McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he hung around for a few years, and then he told me it's not good to be under a big oak tree, you know, for too long.
Sure.
He used to say Marshall was a child.
Life.
What?
Yeah. Morris had had that problem all his life.
Yeah. So, what Barry spelled out, it basically Barry spelled out a part that nobody else could do, a part of McLuhan, and Thiel did the other part, the Finnegan's Wake part, and I don't know if there's someone else who did a third part.
Well, Carpenter helped him see the collective part.
Yeah, maybe Carpenter was the first. It was Carpenter, and then Thiel.
Well,
and
no,
then...
Muller Team was the first.
Yeah.
Muller Team was the first huge personal influence.
Yeah.
And then this is leaving aside his, what I call his European connections.
Yes.
So McLuhan met Gideon and Lewis and...
And Muller Tim. They're all, that's and, the first group.
Yeah, but Muller Tim is as a, you know, a buddy. He's like Carpenter and these guys.
Yeah.
Whereas the European guys are a little bit aloof from...
Yeah.
They're not buddies in any sense at all.
Right.
Jill Sohn belongs to that group. Even Pound, as an honorary European, belongs to that. But what's interesting is all of these guys are tremendously well-educated, and they recognize in McLuhan something that Americans and Canadians couldn't see.
Yeah.
Because the Canadians and Americans, their minds were too constricted.
Yeah, they weren't suave European guys.
Well, they weren't just only suave. They were also very well educated and broadly educated.
Yeah.
And they saw that McLuhan had this broadness that they recognized from Europe, and they recognized that it was unusual in America.
Yes. Another guy was John Pick.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Pick was the editor of Renaissance.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go down that road, then Giovanelli was very important to McLuhan, as both as a intellectual sparring partner and to help him get his stuff published.
And yeah, those guys died. Muller Tim died. Felix died. Carpenter left town. Don got alienated. Harley got sick. Who else is there? John Pick, he married an aristocratic lady, disappeared. Remember we went through him. We looked up his, his history. And there were a couple of English guys that were his friends. The novelist, John somebody.
Yeah, John Wayne.
Yeah. And the...
And Wayne got alienated by McLuhan writing in the TLS supplement that he made fun of the English lower class aspiring to, I don't know, literary competence or something like that.
Yeah.
And Wayne was a lower class guy and had a laborite and... So he didn't talk to McLuhan again. And there were other people like that.
Yeah.
McLuhan often, you know, just let his mouth run.
Yeah, he alienated Frank Kermode and Jonathan Miller, who were fans of his at the beginning.
Yeah. But Jonathan Miller, you know, didn't understand anything about McLuhan. And then his attack is just ridiculous. It's just... And I don't think Kermode can be compared to Miller. Kermode tried to learn from McLuhan and was interested in what McLuhan was saying.
Yeah, and who's the gadfly hopping around in the middle of all this? Robert Fulford.
Yeah, so but to me, he's another guy like Miller who didn't understand what was going on at all. And later came to attack McLuhan.
Yeah. And you know, he wrote a book. He said he was in the best seat in the house.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. They all think that they're the center of the world.
Yeah. And McLuhan occasionally would one-up them by saying it publicly. You know, I'm the only one who knows what's going on. I'm the center for culture and technology. Let's see.
I think if McLuhan, when McLuhan talked like that, he was not meaning it seriously. McLuhan knew that humility was endless, and that it was ridiculous to talk about being a unique seer or something.
Yeah.
The other guys didn't necessarily know that endless humility was necessary.
Yeah, that's where in Take Today, he talks about prophetic awareness, visionary awareness is obsolete. That's what this Kenobian point is indicating.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
That it's a little bit like the fall in Finnegan's Wake. It's very difficult for people to understand that their limitations may be the key to understanding their context.
Yeah.
Generally, people want to think about their brilliance or their great idea or their fulcrum or something like this. But no, it's your limitation. It's your short-sightedness that is the key.
Yeah, the hamartia, the tragic flaw.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll have to come back to this Kenobian. That's an ongoing discussion about what it means.
Yeah. We've gone beyond our time a
yeah.
little bit. Why don't we start with that next time?
Right, because this first time I've ever really discussed it with anybody. I've brought up the Rai idea to different people, but they didn't even know the quote. But this is the first time I've gone over the quote with someone who's reading the quote at the same time. So that's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an important statement, paragraph or two, that nobody talks about.
Sure. Well, I'm gonna think about it and study it a little bit for
yeah.
next time. And if you have the spare moment, you might do the same thing yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to make a note to myself on that quote. I'm not waiting for you to send me a note.
Yes, I might fail to do so.
Yeah, I'm going to do that right now. Make a note to myself what we're going to do. So I guess that's it. We made up for all the missing weeks and started late, but we got a lot done, and you survived it.
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. We'll talk in 2 weeks.
Thanks very much. Yeah, look forward.
Yeah, it was good. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.